Welcome to Sacred Realms, a podcast where a rabbi, a pastor, and a Bible scholar discuss the nexus of science fiction, fantasy, religion, and spirituality. This episode is a What's Happening in the Realm episode, where we will answer the question of the month, talk about what we have been watching or reading lately, talk about news from the science fiction, fantasy, religion news sphere, and then pull something out from the Geniza, something from way back in our past that's still worth dusting off and talking about. We are Rabbi Andrew Pepperstone,
Pastor Travis Smith McKee,
Matthew Umberger,
and this is Sacred Realms. The question of the month is by Travis this month. Travis, what is the question of the month?
Coming from my realm, what we've been watching lately, if you had one food that you could take with you into the apocalypse, and I can think of actually several shows, like I've said, one of my favorite genres is the world is ending, how are we recreating it? Mm-hmm. So anyway, if you had one food to take to the apocalypse with you, what would it be? Like the one that you knew you had to save to make sure that you had that taste going on. So I'll start, because I know I've got this one. Fried okra.
Fried okra?
Now,
you're from Oklahoma.
I am from Oklahoma, and fried okra has been a long time standard from Grandy's. Yeah, if you remember
Grandy's.
Wow. That doesn't exist anymore.
Restaurant chain?
Yeah, and they had just like overly breaded, but also overly slimy okra. It was really great.
It was.
But it's actually, my father-in-law blames my mother-in-law for my wife and I getting married on the fried okra. We went over to their house, meeting a friend. You know, a friend took me over to my now wife's house. And Cassie's mom was making fried okra. And it's like, that's my favorite. So then I just stuck around. He made a joke about it at our wedding. You feed a stray cat or a boyfriend and they'll stick around. So, yeah.
You married into the family for the okra.
It is. It's just, there's not really anything else that will replicate it. It's just the slimy and the crunchy put together. It is absolutely one of my favorite foods.
I like it too.
Yeah.
It's not the one that I would take into the apocalypse.
But okra has definitely got a big bump up just now from that. Well, nothing I claim. I should try okra again.
I'm growing some, so I'll.
Are you really?
Bring you, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So my initial thought was sushi, but it would spoil so fast. So then my secondary thought, which is more of like a Jewish cliche, is matzo ball and chicken soup. That number one, it is the gateway drug to European Jewish cuisine, and really good chicken soup is just really, really good, and it has been proven to be antibiotic. So in double-blind studies, chicken soup is antibiotic. If you boil the chicken with the bones in the pot, the marrow does create an antibiotic function to the soup itself. And a good matzo ball is always very nice. So it's got your protein and carbs. It's good stuff.
You got the texture thing going on too.
Yeah, yeah.
With the matzo ball soup.
Yeah, matzo balls are kind of, they're soft, not slimy, but they're very soft and squishy. And chicken is, you know,
they're got like meatiness.
They are actually matzo ball soup is just chicken and dumplings.
Yeah.
From a Jewish perspective. That's all that it really is. I realized that not that long ago. I'm like, oh, that's what it is.
The secret is the schmaltz, right?
You don't usually see matzo balls made with rendered chicken fat, aka schmaltz, much anymore. But there is a bit of a schmaltz revival happening.
Okay.
Yes. I made it with schmaltz one time. I usually just use oil. The schmaltz ones felt so weird to me. Like, the texture was very, it was overly fatty and greasy. And I did not like
Sounds
the greasy
wonderful.
Matzo ball. I wasn't used to it. Yeah. If I'd only had those, it would have been great. It was purely just a familiarity thing. Matthew, what would you bring to the apocalypse?
I'm going to be boring. I'm going to say bread.
Yeah?
I was immediately thinking staff of life. And, yeah, I just, a good, my wife bakes, we don't usually buy bread. She bakes all the bread that we eat, and it's wonderful. And, yeah, a fresh baked loaf of bread with lots of butter smeared over it. is you can't beat that. I love this question. I'm actually, my dissertation was on, I call it the pre-battle banquet motif, but really about like apocalyptic banquets is a big part of it. So this is a very, in both Jewish and Christian traditions, a lot of pigrapha, a lot of midrash, a lot of Christian apocalyptic writings. You have a lot about banquets.
Okay, yeah.
So here's my mythical answer, Leviathan meat.
Yeah, that's right.
That's served at the banquet at the apocalypse in Jewish mythical thinking.
Oh,
the
meat
of the Leviathan, which is fish, so you can have it, but not with your chicken soup, because in the medieval period, the Leviathan meat and fish together would cause tzaraat.
Okay.
I'm not going to say leprosy. That's a fallacy. You can Google tzaraat. It's a scaly skin disease from Leviticus.
Okay. Yeah.
It's wrong. It's a custom not to eat fish and chicken or fish and meat together.
Okay.
That was very, that appears as a late medieval practice.
I've never heard that explanation.
I've been to Long John Silver's and had the combo platter. So
chicken and fish?
Yeah. I mean,
and you look okay.
I'm fine.
You look okay.
I have a chapter on Leviathan, the Sodat Leviathan, the Leviathan banquet in my book, actually.
Right. Is it whale? Is it alligator? Is it crocodile? Is it just a really, really
none
big
of those are kosher
fish? Actually, I think that Leviathan, this is a foot, Leviathan in Job is described as a worm, W-Y-R-M, like a dragon with no legs and no feet, with a fiery head and a long smoking tail, because it's the memory of an asteroid.
Oh, that's cool.
Which hit the oceans and caused chaos.
Yeah, that's
which
cool.
A Leviathan is seen as a chaos monster.
At church camp, I was taught that the Job's Leviathan was actually a dinosaur, and it's a memory of like.
But it has no. But it has no legs.
Yeah.
And it has no arms.
I know, you're right.
No, but it has. But I do believe that dragon stories are because of dinosaur bones.
Oh,
they go, what was this? And they're not so off.
Yeah.
They're not too wrong. Right. They are like huge lizard creatures. So yeah, Leviathan is fun. So, what have we been watching and reading lately? Matthew, you've done some catching up.
I've been doing a lot of catching up. It's summer break. I don't want my wife to listen to this because she's going to say, what have you been doing?
The yarn needs to be mowed. Come on now.
True media confessions.
But I have told her, no, I have to, Rabbi Andrew wants me to watch this. So I'm throwing you under
the
bus.
Heavy. It's homework. I have to.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
I've been watching Agatha All Along, which came out about a year ago. Is that right? I think it was around Halloween, actually.
Okay.
I will say I enjoyed it. It is very well done. Like, artistically, probably peak MCU. It's kind of weird. I watched it right after having watched the Captain America Brave New World, which is not peak MCU.
No.
And it gave me a little bit of whiplash. It made me feel uncomfortable, you know, as a devout Catholic. I take religious claims very seriously. And so Agatha All Along comes from a Wiccan perspective, and it's not treated as fantasy or as much as some of the other things in the MCU. Like magic, for instance, I think about the Asgardians. You know, Thor is not the god of the ancient Nordic peoples. He is from another planet, and I think there's a line in the first Thor movie that, like, this looks like magic to us because they're so far technologically advanced.
Right, the Arthur C. Clarke comics.
Yeah, that's
any
right.
Any sufficiently advanced technology looks like magic to an inexperienced person. Like our iPads would look like magic to somebody from 300 years ago. They go, yeah, it looks like magic.
Yeah, good connection with the Arthur C. Clarke, yeah. I think the MCU is starting to explore other possibilities of magic now, and Agatha All Along is a good example of this. I mean, it ends with a ghost. Like, this. So we're kind of outside of science fiction now. We're into other spiritual realities. And there are, so it's a competing religious claim. And so, yeah, that's a, I think it's good for me to be exposed to those competing claims, but they're competing claims. And so, yeah, it was a little awkward. I appreciated how blunt they were about the goal of what the people on the Witch's Road in this series are doing, with the goal being power. At the end, it seems none of them really attain what they think they've gone through it to attain. I guess Wiccan sort of does. He finds
Wiccan the character.
Yeah, his finds his brother. As a practicing Catholic, having power, the attainment of power as your goal in life, I think, is dangerous and it ultimately is self-destructive.
I think Agatha's story in that show tells that story.
Yeah.
I mean, she has power, but it's never enough to actually keep her son alive.
That's true. Yeah, no, that's
so,
a good point.
So she's tragic.
Yeah.
In that sense where, you know, she's always on the run hoping that the next time she, you know, does what she does, she won't need to pay with her son's life. And that was, and she's dating death. I mean, death is her lover, right. Which is a very interesting, bizarre story. I mean, interestingly done.
So, yeah, having the personification of death, who is from the comics, and so Lady Death is a character.
Actually, she is Thanos' girlfriend.
Yeah.
In a lot of it. Actually, Thanos does the snap to impress her.
That's right.
Look what I did. I killed half of all life. Aren't you impressed?
Yeah.
I don't know if she is or isn't in the comics. I haven't read them. But he does it to impress Lady Death.
Mm. Yeah.
I think Aubrey Plaza would not be impressed. She's so whatever.
I really enjoyed the acting and, that character is phenomenal. Yeah, fun to watch.
Yeah, right. The writing, excellent. The acting, excellent.
There's an entirely different perspective as to what's being given. I mean, Jack Schaefer, Jack with a no K, you know, is a woman.
Okay, yeah.
The focused characters are women and queer folks.
And over 40.
Yeah, and
there are very, very few shows that have women in central roles who are middle-aged or older, and it definitely, that's what it was.
They were leaning into the crone, like the maiden mother crone.
That was in the show itself. I've been told not to use that term by women because that is not viewed positively, even though it is an archetype.
Right.
Yeah, but it was in the show itself.
Maiden
mother crone. And Agatha goes through all three of those stages. Yeah. She begins the maiden, becomes the mother, and then she becomes the crone.
I would not call any of these actors crones in real life.
No, no, no.
But there's I think
they're all younger than George Clooney. And he's still,
Even Patti LuPone?
No.
She's been around for such a long time.
But the trope of, you know, like George Clooney in his, you know, upper 50s, he plays a leading man, and his love interest is a woman that has to be in her 20s. And it's like, that's creepy in real life, but, you know, in a movie, that's just normal.
George Clooney has in his attic a portrait of him as an aged man, because he is clearly Dorian Gray.
on the next episode of Sacred Realms.
The portrait of Dorian Gray.
The portrait of George Clooney. But, yeah, and I think, like, being able to present Marvel recognizing the need for multiple vantage points in storytelling and asking us what makes us truly uncomfortable. When we understand everything, there's a different sense of entitlement. And I think that's maybe one thing to the new Captain America movie, is it leaning into things that the general audience would understand, or is it leaning into a new perspective in storytelling? And when it recycles those old tales, then it just becomes something that we can understand and that we can control, and we get frustrated that it's not what we fell in love with before. In many ways, A, being able to tell their stories, but B, being able to get us as uncomfortable with what's going on. There's a storytelling technique to that, But then also, like you said, being exposed to it yourself. I think the religious aspect of it is, if we just are in the existence without seeing what, you know, seeing from others' perspectives, we may even have our own enemies without knowing who they are, where they're coming from, anything like that. And so, yeah, I think that there's certainly a religious exercise in being aware of that. Yeah. As opposed to the satanic panic, you know, get rid of everything that's doing that. So, I think there's something really neat to being able to hear from that perspective without saying, because I have watched this, I have now taken on, this is my persona.
Right. I will say, I do appreciate how, I think is the most religious thing the MCU has produced. Has the most religious ideas, easily. I can't think of another. Because as opposed to like Thor, you know, nobody is offering sacrifices to Thor in any of these movies.
Right.
So they've made a decision to explore, I'd say, honest to goodness, religious questions, questions of spirituality. And I appreciate that. The scene with the bar mitzvah.
Yeah, the opening scene of Billy's bar mitzvah was really well done, from a Jewish point of view. It was done in a very like dreamlike, impressionist kind of way. It wasn't done, you know, like, it wasn't like you were watching a bar mitzvah happen in a synagogue. It wasn't like that. But everybody had the right ritual garb on, the tallises looked right, and the synagogue felt like a synagogue, but in a dreamlike kind of way. And the Torah reading, which they did not explain on screen, it did not translate, was so beautifully chosen. It was the death of Aaron's two sons from Leviticus, which ties back to WandaVision and Wanda having to lose her two boys when she lets her reality hex down, as well as Vision going away, but now they're going to go find White Vision. And so that was really well done, and it was very nice and subtle. I noticed that YouTubers who I watch, New Rock Stars and Screen Crush, like, their Jewish sources told them what it was, what they found out, and they were equally surprised at how fitting it was for the theme. I really, really liked the obviousness of being on a set on the Witch's Road. It was clearly not a location, deliberately a fabricated movie studio.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because it was Billy's imagination.
Mm.
Come to life. That was very cleverly done. Like, why did they do a studio for that? Because it was not real.
Yeah, it felt
It was constructed by his connection to Wanda, which is to the Reality Stone. So his magic is part of, like, the sci-fi, you know, Reality Stones. And their magic is unclear how it kind of fits in with that, if it does at all. They're tapping into something real in the MCU, which is very interesting to me.
Yeah, they haven't defined that yet.
Right.
But it's interesting, he kept resorting to what he called analog magic.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a cute term. But I mean, that's, as far as I could tell, that was like straight out of like Wicca. Like, and,
Wicca, yeah.
Yeah.
There's an article I read many years ago, is the magic in Harry Potter novels kosher or not? Because there's always a question. Within the Five Books of Moses sources, there's a whole bunch of prohibitions against engaging in magic of all kinds.
That's right.
Divination, necromancy, sorcery, whatever, all kinds of stuff. They have some very strange ideas about what it is. A lot of it sounds like ventriloquism. Mm-hmm. To fool people. So one take on it is, it's all nonsense, you're being scammed. One take on it is, it's all real, but Jews don't touch that because we just don't mess with those things, but they're real.
Yeah.
So this stuff took the
Catholics
more...
Catholics would take that state.
It's real, don't mess with it. And it depends if you're reading like a rationalist or a mystic within Jewish sources. They're basically split. I take the, you're being scammed, don't bother with those things. One of the weirdest ones is they make voices come out of their armpits. These necromancers.
Oh,
like,
fun.
That's where they would like throw their voice coming out of their armpit. I'm like, that's bizarre. But that's where they would do it. Come like out. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's just the thing. That's
I
mean, a thing.
I take it there is one MCU property and I guess it's still Daredevil.
Is yes,
very religious. He is very good Catholic.
Charlie Cox is a devout Catholic, and in the most recent Daredevil series,
I haven't seen
it. Is so. I thought it was really, really good. Fisk is amazing. It's really interesting, but you see him kind of like outside the church.
Yeah.
And you see him, you kind of see the church juxtaposed with the courtroom, which is his other sacred space.
Yeah.
And you see him lose faith in the justice system.
Yeah.
But he grapples with his faith all the time. I mean, the imagery in the show, he really grapples with, you know, what he actually puts his faith in. And he is left with, he has to put back on the mask. Yeah. And he has to take it back into his own hands.
Yeah. So as a Catholic, the older seasons of that are so genuine. Like, I mean, all the comic book stuff is fake, but the spiritual torment and the scenes of him, his conversations with the priests are so good. And in season two, his rooftop conversation with Frank Castle, the Punisher, is like really good Catholic theology, actually.
And he's back in the Born Again series. He's great.
Yeah,
I love the actor playing.
Oh yeah, Frank Castle. He's another Jewish actor.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't look into his background. There's no in the classic sources like a Jewish vigilante. There is Samson.
Samson.
Yeah, he is sort of like a superhero archetype in some ways. He has, you know, the long hair. He has superhuman abilities. He has anger issues. And he is not regarded as a role model.
Yeah.
He is like a bit of a warning about trust in the outsider as a weakness.
Yeah.
And trust in women as a weakness. He's a problematic figure. But he is definitely like an archetype for a lot of superhero stuff. The most superhero-like figure in the Hebrew Bible that I'm aware of. On the page.
Yeah.
Other figures become superheroes with later rabbinic writings. Different story. Yeah, Abraham becomes a super... Abraham, in rabbinic mind, becomes, for the rabbis, the original Superman.
Okay, wow. That's interesting.
Abraham as Superman is a very interesting motif.
We're going to have
a lot of things really do fit.
Stabbing Abraham, he
gets stabbed, and the knife shatters. So he is even like a man of steel. I would say man of iron, because it's not the... It's bronze age still. But he even has like a knife shatter on his body when he tries to get stabbed, and it just shatters into little pieces. Because his superpower is monotheism. But Superman is coming up later on this month, that's for sure.
And let's talk about Abraham. I want
to
hear about this.
Yeah, for sure. We will. We will come to that. I've been watching the show Murderbot on Apple TV. I know I mentioned it last episode, and I've been watching more recently and just really loving how it is grappling with what it means to be human. Even in like one or two episodes, the questions of, can we overcome our own innate programming? Like, can we actually change or not?
Mm. That's interesting.
Is even a sec unit who is like partially made from human flesh and bone and sinew, is he made in God's image or not? Mm. Like, is he an it or is he a thou? And, you know, people want to treat him like an it. He's a robot, but there's enough of like human stuff in him to where maybe he's not just an it. And even if he is an it, what does it mean to treat something that is a robot like a thou? Does that make it? It's in God's image. It's interesting. You know, every succubus has a unique face, but they have masks. And they ask the question, why do they make every succubus have a unique face? Well, if they're all having a unique face, then maybe they actually are all basically just like modified humans with robot parts. But they really are essentially human, but controlled. Mm-hmm. But this one overcomes its governing module and goes rogue, but has to play...
I was going to
say... It's still being governed, lets it be, you know, scrapped for parts.
The question that I have from that is asking, you know, when that robot, Murderbot, has...
That's his name for himself.
Okay.
Or when its name for itself?
Yeah.
Unclear. Is poor, it here in it?
It's poor marketing if you call your robot a murder bot.
No, that is actually his secret name in his own mind. He names himself.
Right.
And that makes me think about Genesis 2, when God brings the human, all the animals, and the human names them all. There's a really interesting midrash where God asks Adam, like, what should your name be? And he says, well, I come from the Adama, the earth. I guess I'll be Adam, the earthling.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then God says, well, what's my name? And Adam gives God a name. And in the Midrash, it says, well, you do seem to transcend space and time. How about Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton? And God said, that's my name. And then, so humanity names God in this rabbinic Midrash. So the rabbis understand that humanity essentially experiences God and then tries to understand God in part by naming. So part of how he understands himself, and he's grappling with his own glitchy, fuzzy memories from his own past, is he massacred people. He doesn't know why or what the circumstance was. So he calls himself, in his own mind, Murderbot. But when they learn what his name is, people freak out. He's not quite sure why he's the Murderbot. But that is how he describes himself at that point.
So he shares his name with others?
No. Oh, okay. During an electric mind meld, if you will, with another human who has some upgrades, the human discovers his name against his own will. And it's a bit of a revelation, and they kind of go, oh my gosh. Yeah, it's an interesting series.
I mean, it sounds like it also gets into, I haven't seen any of it, but it sounds like it gets into questions of how we frame our identity and how others, what names do others give us? What names do we give ourselves? Uh-huh. How do we, and which of those is real? Is authentic. So
he names himself Murderbot, but he just gets called Secunit. I mean, it's not even a name, it's just like a it's like calling your coffee pot Mr. Coffee. It's a brand name.
And my question from earlier was asking, what do your unique experiences have for you? Because my coffee pot will have different experiences than your coffee pot, because no one's actually following it to the exact T as to what's going on. It will have a different, a unique thing, and we can have intended purposes for it or not, which typically robots, we kind of think of that way. But if the robot is supposed to be interacting and involved with people, people will change it. People will make it its unique thing. And so that's where you're saying sentience comes in, is this robot will be different from the other. This robot will have a different face. This robot will have a different mannerisms as to how it's interacting with people based off of what it's done.
And they fluctuate between wanting it to have its mask off and feel part of the team, but at times they go, just put the mask back on. We can't handle it right now.
Yeah.
Or actually, it can't handle, or he can't handle being viewed as human. It needs to separate itself a little bit from these people who he wants to protect, but also drive him crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Which feels very human. He watches thousands of hours of a soap opera in his own viewing, heads-up display. And he uses some of the experiences of the soap opera to try to relate to people.
Right.
Here's how to actually, calm someone down or to be compassionate with somebody. So he tried to draw upon the soap opera. And they're also trying to figure out, has he actually really watched 10,000 hours? And he drops some line. One goes, oh my god, well, that's a really deep cut from this one soap opera that they've all watched.
I'm thinking about if I tried to relate to people based on just media consumption, what my life would if that's what I thought was like. But that was how I was.
There's an empathy thing to it as well. There have been studies about the effects of Sesame Street. Kids will always have to be interactive with somebody, and sometimes parents have to do things. So they put them in front of Sesame Street, and there's something to the empathetic nature as to what you're learning from there, the problem solving that comes along with it, versus just here is ABC or something like that. Sure. There's something to the emotions that come along with it. And I think that the best children's programming has a lot of that. We're sitting here in my office. I've got my Bluey stuff on that. My daughter loves Bluey.
Oh, my kids do too.
Which is the best fantasy show in the world. Yes, parents have all the time in the world to play with their kids and never have to do their jobs and stuff like that, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, your consumption does affect what's going on within there. But be aware, and this maybe comes back to our Agatha stuff, be aware of what your consumption is. You know, where does your consumption butt up against what your intended reality is? That really speaks quite a bit to what possibilities you can have. Now I'm curious to get into Murderbot. That'll be my insomnia show. My hey, I wake up in the middle of the night show or something like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Travis, you got watching Paradise?
Yeah. So, first of all, the follow-up show from This Is Us does not sound like a fantasy sci-fi type show at all, right? And especially because the entire first episode is a murder mystery of the president and a Secret Service agent finding the president dead. Now, I don't know, we haven't gone over our strict definition of spoilers here, but this also happens at the end of the first episode.
Okay.
So I think first episode, it's hard to spoil, you know, entirely that, but it is the last thing that happens in the first episode that you find out that this president is president of an underground city of 25,000 people that had been excavated under a mountain in case of a global disaster. What the global disaster is, that comes later in the show. So if you've watched This Is Us at all, you know that timelines are flimsy. There's a lot of flashbacks that go along with it, and it's really fascinating. I really appreciated the way that it treated the scientific realities of what it meant to be underground.
Yeah.
Because you don't... You can kind of see that something's a little bit off with it, in that you go from, hey, here's my small town walking by my little neighborhood ice cream store, into the White House, which is not a reality. You could tell that some things were off that way, but sunlight looks like sunlight. Mm-hmm. Daytime is daytime, except for when there's planned maintenance for the daytime. Oh, yeah. And they say, hey, we know this is normal, and so they have to communicate what becomes normal, because they do come underground because of a global disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you deal with the grief of that?
How far into the post-disaster timeline are they?
It's like months, right?
Months to maybe a year.
So it's fresh. It's fresh in everyone's mind.
And so that's the weird thing, is like...
They're celebrating a year, isn't it?
Like versus...
Oh, yeah, the fair is like somewhere around a year. Going underground... What becomes the normal of this? And so this is where our question came from, is that they had a psychologist that was tasked with being, you know, to set up the psychological aspects of the community under there. And she bragged about, like, the number of people that made it ideal and all these other sort of things. But then she really got specific and said, I was tasked with finding the world's best cheese fries. Not really good cheese fries, but the world's best. And then she reveals that they're made from nuts. Like, because you don't have cows underground.
I assume cashews.
I think it's cashew milk or something like that.
Because cashew milk is the best candidate so far for plant-based cheese products.
Yeah. Huh.
So far.
Yeah, because you can't really have the methane from cows coming out there. So they have those other replacements. How much can you actually control about life? Everybody's got, ironically, it looks more like a Fitbit more than an Apple Watch.
Mm-hmm.
We're sponsored here by, we're not sponsored on this show. But, you know, they've got a Fitbit that controls where they're going. It controls how they pay.
But they have an economy.
There is an economy. Without spoiling too much, there's definitely an economy. But it's supposed to be paradise, so you don't see people who are doing without. You might see people who are doing with more, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
I would say that the, you know, without spoiling too much of it, because honestly, I think that Matthew, you've watched a few episodes of it.
Yeah, 4 or 5 episodes.
Yeah,
yeah.
The giant twist, the whodunit, is not revealed literally at all until the last episode. If you get it before then, I'm impressed.
Is it possible?
I genuinely don't think so.
Mm. So there are not enough clues to actually
figure
it out.
Yeah, but you see how interwoven the whodunit part is, but then also like the motivation behind it. So Dan Fogelman is again really good with This Is Us at like taking your heart and just squeezing every emotion out of it. And that's how the whodunit is revealed. But it's in such a way that like how did this underground bunker get made? Who
are these flashbacks?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who's not inside the bunker? What is the reaction to those who are outside being part of it? And again, it's that idea of control. How much can you control of what's going on? Where do you find grace and forgiveness for people who are doing the worst things for the best reasons? And so it is, I was, one of my favorite podcasts talks about TV, and they watched the first 2 episodes and went, oh my gosh, did AI come up with this? Because it seems very concocted. And it is.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean.
But it is very concocted. But by the time they got to the 7th episode, it was like... The 7th episode is just an amazing episode of television. The realness of it, it's not gritty, bloody realness, but it is real stakes, real emotions as to what's going on within this. And so it pieces together a lot of stuff that's going on.
When I started it, I didn't think I was going to get past the first episode.
Yeah. Because
it's like every other post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, well, Fallout,
I just saw Fallout, yeah.
Yeah, this sounds like Fallout, Silo, exactly. Underground Bunkers.
Yep.
And I love both of those shows a lot.
I was like, I don't need another one of these. But by the end of that first episode, I was like, oh, there's something different going on. Or maybe it was the second episode, but it feels, and I think a lot of it is there's a stronger accent on the human element,
right,
than Fallout for sure.
And again, a different approach to the human element of this. So many of our shows like that tend to be like, I, this one person, am able to save the whole world.
Right.
And now, I think they had to set up a second season. So the very last scene is, I, the one person, am going to try to save the whole world next season. You know, that sort of thing.
Of course, next season.
So if you can ignore the last 3 minutes of a TV show, I think it was great. I think it was a great miniseries. I'm going to be curious what it can do. But like there's this issue of hope that goes along with there too, because the outside world is destroyed. Inside is all that we care about.
Do you know how much is actually destroyed? Or are you led to believe, oh, it's all gone, but not really?
I got to the part where they were sending out, like, the
explorers. You find out more truth. So the answer is complicated and obscured enough that there's a second season.
Okay.
You find out enough to think there could be something that goes along with there. Silo, in that same way of like asking, oh, is the outside really that dangerous?
Hope is the thing that keeps them going.
Yeah, I mean, like the hope of, and I think it's that hope of grief. Who are the people that you're missing?
Hope of grief?
Like if I'm missing my significant other that was out there, are they looking for me? And do you ignore that this person who shaped your life, that you loved so much, do you ignore, like just turn off the part that they existed and everything is what happens under this mountain? Or do you hold out some hope that they could still be alive? So do you talk about your wife as your ex-wife or still your wife? Because you don't have confirmation if she's gone or not. again, like you said, the human aspect of it explored it in a different way. And again, I love Silo. Silo takes place hundreds of years underground.
They aren't even sure how long it's been.
Yeah, no one can be sure how long it's been. Whereas this is so fresh that the people that you love, maybe there's a weird chance they survive, but we don't know
right. The
Schrodinger's cat of the outside, whereas so many of them are, we don't know because it's been generations. Yeah. I think there's certainly some morality, but it's just a self-actualization that comes from that too, of who am I? I would see that in so many of our religious stories of, am I what was? Am I what's coming forward? Like, what role does the past play in my current? And what hope does paradise, an external afterlife, if you will, hold within this?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking so much about the period after the destruction of the first temple with the elite of Judean population being exiled to Babylon. Not all, just really it was just the elite. Mm-hmm. And the Jeremiah telling them to settle down.
That's right.
Like, build houses, build gardens, have kids, you live there.
Yeah.
You know, you're not coming back.
It's going to be a while.
It's going to be a while. So settle in. Not that they were as isolated as they were in a bunker in Paradise or Silo or Fallout, but they were going to be living here in Babylon, which was good. Life was good in Babylon. Yeah. Babylon was very nice. We actually have records from that time period in Babylon. The Jewish population there was doing very well. Like, they had businesses, they were involved locally, they lived there, and most never came back.
Right.
Most never returned. So it's almost like if the bunker were to open up again, how many would actually stay in that reality? How many would actually go back to the other reality? And I think about when some did go back home and they began to build the second temple, a few people remember the first one.
Oh, yeah.
And they are in this weird, like, grieving what was, but happy there's a new start, and they're in tears. Mm-hmm. Because they remember what was, and what is being built right now sucks. Yeah. It's pathetic compared to the old days.
Yeah.
You know, Solomon's Temple. And, the Second Temple was not great for a long time. It gets great under Herod. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Herod really built what we think of as the Second Temple. It was very middling for a few centuries.
Mm-hmm. My question, you say the elite go.
Yeah, the elite are exiled, making the population who remains far easier to control with an installed governor.
Oh, okay, yeah. So then,
basically farmers.
Those in Babylon
were the elite.
What is that dynamic like? If they are the elite who are out there and have their own, like, do they have concern for those that were left behind?
You do see in the Talmud centuries of resentment that the Judean population is really angry at the Babylonian Jews. And there's centuries of tension between who is the real center of power for the Jewish people. And they will literally fight this out for centuries, especially who controls the calendar. So there's a lot of ongoing tension. Mm-hmm. There's critique that the Jews of Babylon, they just come back as tourists and they don't really stay. That there's a revolving door. They come and they go. You know, they're not there to build and do the hard work of rebuilding a second commonwealth. And you see this critique in the 19th century, 20th century with the emergence of Israel, the state, and Jews, the diaspora, and they have their own tension between those living in the land of Israel and those living in diaspora. There's always been, it's the same tension between those in, those outside the land.
But the center of Judaism, I always call it the Vatican of Judaism, was really, like, is it Pumbedita? Is that the...
Nahardea and Pumbedita were kind of the two major academic centers of Jewish
which
life.
Are in they're ancient Babylonia.
Yeah, they're in Iraq today.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're in the... They're in, and they really were the center.
The common era.
As the Roman Empire declined, Babylon really becomes the center. When the caliphate moves to Babylon, like, in the 9th century, the Gaonim, the rabbinic leaders there, really become powerful, mm-hmm. and they make the Talmud constitutional. Mm-hmm. But then when that caliphate declines, then Jews begin spreading out all across North Africa and move up into Western and then ultimately Eastern Europe. Okay. So, and then it's really very, very decentralized. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like the Gaonim of Babylon with that much power in one location ever again,
yeah.
really.
But, but that would have been a holdover from the Babylonian exile, like the transfer of all of the elite to Babylon.
Yeah, right? it does.
Because it never
emptied out from Babylon. Yeah. They were all,
mm-hmm.
and then in the second century CE, you know, it kind of like, right, it becomes then even more influential.
I'm now hearing a better story for Paradise Season 2. No, I mean, like, there's a reason why I got into asking about the billionaires go into the bunker as well. If the entire world is going to be destroyed, who gets to go inside? Mm-hmm. And in many ways, the people who work in the bunker are there at the service of the billionaires, but they're taken care of. So your thing earlier about the indentured servants, it may not be quite that, but it's not far from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have this question of, are the elites living fine while they're not thinking about the others? And what does it take to return from Babylon?
To restore the old civilization?
Yeah, dear Dan Fogelman, I want to see that Jewish take of paradise. Yeah.
Isn't there a midrash that says that basically, like, Haman is allowed to rise to power because the elite Jews had not gone back to Judea?
Ooh, interesting.
Haven't I heard that somewhere?
I'm not. I don't know that one. There's a lot of midrash out there. That one I haven't come across. Doesn't mean it's not out there. I just haven't come across it. You know, how does Haman rise? Because his rise to power is kind of out of the blue. And how does it happen? So it certainly is a question that they would ask.
Zechariah, I think it's Zechariah, has the verse about, I'll send hunters and fishermen after you to bring you back. Like, it's more aggressive than Isaiah, where, like...
Well, Zechariah was living in Judea. He and Haggai and Malachi are the last of the prophets, and they were trying to get people to come back, and it's just... Life in Babylon was so nice.
Yeah.
It was the big city. Ziggurats and hanging gardens and, you know, they don't have droughts. They have rivers that flood regularly. Why would we leave an area that has no droughts for a city that has guaranteed periods of drought? Like, it's not easy being an agrarian civilization in an area that is totally rain dependent, that does not always get enough rain.
It's
hard. But the floodplains are great. Egypt, Babylon, the big cities.
Yeah.
That's why those are the big cities. They don't have droughts.
So Travis, you love these post-apocalyptic things.
I picked up on it, I mean, absolutely during COVID. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
which definitely felt on point for COVID.
I think I had the opposite reaction to COVID. I was like,
no, I don't need this reality.
Yeah.
But it was
it didn't feel like science fiction.
Yeah, Station 11 was one of the most comforting things I found during COVID, of like what happens when everything gets shut down. And again, that ask of how do we rebuild, I think it also comes with COVID.
Sure.
I would argue that the number of people who were within religious institutions, who are within government powers, who said, COVID has not affected me. Why are we shutting everything down? Why are we thinking about those the most affected by this when it's not affecting all of us? And so that, you know, paradise kind of played in a lot of ways for that too, of why think about those that I can't see? You know, I just had an interaction with somebody from China whose family lived in China during the height of COVID. And the first question that somebody from here in the U.S. had was, how did you get your groceries delivered to you? Like, were you able to go out and get groceries? And, you know, I went back to thinking about that, too, of like...
Interesting.
you know, whereas I didn't work, you know, in the same way at my church, and especially for the first couple of months, there was not much going on, but grocery stores stayed open. Mm-hmm. And it was my escape to get out and go grocery shopping with my daughter, both of us wearing masks. Mm-hmm. Yet, who had to work in that grocery store? Who had to drive trucks? Who had to work with the electrical company to make sure all that stuff was going on? And so just expanding that idea of who are we thinking about was really important too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, the little people that make everything work. Like in Silo, who's actually living on the bottom floor, keeping us all alive? Because if they're not happy, they shut off the air, we're dead in 12 hours.
Yeah, and the realization, Silo, I love because it's the recognition that those at the bottom do have the power. Mm-hmm. That's the perspective that it takes.
They literally keep the lights on.
The upper levels need to control the bottom levels in order to keep their power. But what happens when they recognize they're essential?
Right. There's the power of information, the power of narrative control, and there's the power of light, heat, and food and air. There's like there's very different kinds of power at the top and at the bottom. And in the middle, there's different kinds of power too. There's the power of fixing things, the power of being a runner up the stairs to actually courier things around. So a lot of interesting kinds of power all to play up and down the silo.
I haven't seen Silo.
Oh, it's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Number one, Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah, Rebecca Ferguson. Yeah.
She's fantastic. She's great. And Tim Robbins. Oh. Common.
Oh.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
All right, well, what are we looking forward to? What's coming up?
Still coming up. Fantastic Four, a new trailer just came out. It's now clearly about their child, Reed and Susan Richards. It's about their child who is a... He can, like, create galaxies and worlds. He's a major... And it may be that he is so powerful, that's why Galactus is going to eat Earth, is to kill him. So... That's interesting. It looks really, really good. Superman's coming out in 10 days. That's exciting.
At time of recording, yes.
Yeah, at time of recording.
We may be releasing this after Superman or something like that.
And
after
you mentioned the Project Hail Mary.
Project Hail Mary is basically one of the Ryans plays a...
Seacrest!
but he plays a scientist that can't get traction of talking to people about... his biggest things that are going on and gets in trouble with institutions. And then it turns out that he might be right in that sons are dying and they're trying to figure out how to restore sons, because obviously there's one son that we're operating around that we would like to keep going, right? So they send him out to one that is thriving. But here's the thing. He lost his credibility with a lot of folks, so he's been a middle school teacher. And so now it's basically taking this middle school teacher, putting him under. He has the line, "I'm not an astronaut, I'm an astronaut." It seems like goofy and silly and funny in some of those ways. Gosling, it's Ryan Gosling. But it seems really great. So it is a book. It comes out.
Andy Weir of The Martian
fame. Yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
And Artemis... His film noir murder mystery set on the moon.
Yeah.
In the first moon city called Artemis. Also, very good book.
Huh.
It comes out in March, so we've got some time.
Okay.
You can read the book if you want. I think I'm going to be doing that here soon. I saw the trailer for it, and I said, okay, that looks fun. I'm looking forward to that.
Cool. Anything else on your horizon?
Nah.
Me neither.
I'm going to keep watching MCU.
All right. You keep watching the MCU.
Move on to the next series, I guess.
So speaking of From the Geniza, you're going through and looking at all the MCU stuff. I just wanted to mention, speaking of Paradise, a young adult literature series that my kids read and I read several years ago. It's not that old, called The City of Ember. It is a city underground. It's like a normal, sort of like old-timey, you know, wooden building city, all run on electricity. And surrounded by complete darkness.
Wow.
And they don't know why they're there. They don't know what else is out there, how long it's been. Everything is kind of fraying and getting worn out. They reuse and recycle everything. They sing together as a community in the town square. There's a strong sense of like in being interwoven and responsible for each other. And then they begin to discover that things are breaking down. They need replace. There actually is a plan for egress. And they do actually get everybody out. There's also been a scandal with, you know, do the leaders, are the leaders hoarding and living a high life that we're not? There is that as well. And so there are four books in the series. There's The City of Ember, Sparks, which is once they get out and they go to the nearest town, then there's the issue of scarcity and who gets resources. All of a sudden, who are these people, these outsiders, strangers from underground? And then, you know, they have like limited resources and how do they interact? And then the next one is called...
It's Prophet of Yawnwood.
Prophet of... Well, that's the fourth one or the third one?
That's... So I'm looking at it there, yeah. People of Sparks, Prophet of Yawnwood, Diamond of Darkhold.
Diamond of Darkhold. Diamond of Darkhold is actually like a flashback prequel novel.
Oh, no, the Prophet is.
The Prophet is? Oh, right. Yeah. The Prophet is like the prequel third episode or third book is about how it all came to be.
Hmm.
Like, why they're underground, what happened. Diamond of Darkhold is when they discover what they buried for when people actually got back to the surface, which is basically an unlimited power resource to help them rebuild. So there was an apocalypse. It is post-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
But the Earth's not irradiated. It just... Not much left.
Okay.
Very good series. Very good series. Another one is also... Is another kind of like a hunkering down apocalypse. Is Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson. There's like three parts of the book. Part one is... Something hits the moon and turns it into like seven huge rocks. Which they call, I think... Seven Sisters or the Sisters, and they go, oh, interesting, and then they go, oh, but they keep hitting each other and it's accelerating and it's going to cause a huge rain of moon rock and dust. It's going to cover the entire Earth. We have to get up off the surface before it happens. And so it's about the race to get into orbit or to hunker down when that happens. That's like part one of the book. Part two is stabilizing life in orbit. Like living in orbit around the Earth as a civilization.
Yeah.
And then, and there's seven, the seven Eves are part of that stabilizing of civilization. Really interesting the role the Amish play.
Wow.
In orbital Earth, in that they have this a mystic principle, which is that overly powerful technology is not desirable. Basically, we don't need this. We'll only make the tech that we actually need. And they reduce the power of their technology beyond what is necessary, which is a very interesting kind of restraint. They call it the mystic principle. So Amish philosophy finds its way into the future in their design ethic.
Weird.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that sounds really
interesting.
It was
a very interesting novel. Really, so those are just two, like, you know, post-apocalyptic, one for children and one for adults.
Yeah.
They came out, 70s was not too long ago. City of Ember was, what years did those come out?
The early 2000s.
Okay, so 20 years.
The books, but yeah.
Over to, and they did make a movie of the City of Ember, which we found to be very disappointing, because it's never as good as the book. Bill Murray plays the mayor. And he's great because he's fun.
Yeah.
But that those were those are my From the Geniza picks, inspired by your watching of Paradise.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah. So that concludes this episode of Secret Realms. What's happening in the realms? Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy this conversation about the nexus of sci-fi, fantasy, religion, and spirituality, and come back to hear more. Our next episode will very likely focus on Superman, the new one, and come out later this summer. If you like this episode, please leave us a positive rating or review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you prefer to find your podcast. This episode was recorded and edited using Descript, and you can reach us over email at sacredrealmspodcast@gmail.com. Keep exploring the sacred and the realms.
Wonderful.
Why not?